David White contributed the image of a natural fire to our conference title when he met with interest group leaders and executive committee members in January. That image has continued to resonate deeply in me. Fire expands and contracts depending on circumstance. It expands into passionate dance and draws back into glowing embers. As David says, the image itself allows us to invite all parts of ourselves here, the parts that are growing and expanding, as well as that in us which is drawing within, diminishing and even dying out. The image comforted me in January because patience and endurance were my companions on the inner journey, passion seemingly a past memory. This evening, I take heart from the encouragement implied in the image as we gather together. I am very happy to welcome all of us, all parts of us, who are here for what I believe will be a wonderful conference. And now, I ask Jean Matlack to come forward. Jean is a member of the Speaker Search Committee who has been our contact with David White and who will also introduce him.
You will be more interested in how David White became the man he is after you hear him than you are now, because most of you don't yet know what it's like to be with David White when he's working as he will be with us. I remember the first time I heard him at a large conference in Washington, D.C. 2.5 years ago. After the applause died down, I said, "Who is that man?" I will tell you just a little. He's not really only a poet. He's also a bard. He leads retreats to places like Bhutan and the Galapagos. He works with a wide variety of groups doing what he will do with us, with corporations, colleges, and conferences. Drawing on poems by many authors, David draws us into a pilgrimage with him, into an exploration of the inner mountains and islands. He surrounds us with the voices of travelers who have gone before us, voices David has made his own, and to which he adds his own. Welcome, David.
A small symbolic act here of turning the pulpit round to face the other way. As you can see, there are just a few notes, books. In some ways, I want to. It's not that there isn't a place for the pulpit in our life. In some ways, I feel in our spiritual evolution, we began to hide behind the pulpit. And that in some ways we can only address ourselves and address our inner life from a kind of pulpit, and that in a very deep way interferes with our self-compassion. And so not to belabor it too much, but just to turn the pulpit round and stand out here to start working with our theme for the weekend, which is a natural fire, patience and passion on the spiritual journey. In some ways, what I want to ask us to do this weekend is not to choose between them. There's a way in which we can get passionate about our patience and then ask ourselves to be very patient about our passion, because it doesn't seem to be anywhere near us or anywhere in sight. And what I would ask this weekend is to look at the weekend not in the sense of taking on a burden, in the sense of something to learn. Here's yet another way of looking at things that I have to take on into the way I look at life already. but to see it as an unburdening, a kind of giving away, because in my own studies of the poetic tradition and the mythic tradition say that actually this is the first step you take. It's not one of taking on, but of giving away in a very profound way. What's it like to let our passion naturally arise out of our patience, spontaneously arise out of our patience, or our patience spontaneously arise out of our passion? What is it like to have all the different rivers of our experience inside us be allowed to flow down to the central sea of our deeper longings and desires? And I want to work with desire and longing this weekend. In some ways, again, in our spiritual traditions, in their suspicion of surface desire, we've become suspicious of our own deeper desires. And in some ways, I feel we've lost the facility of touching them, because we've become so allergic and so afraid of the surface desires, of what desire means. You get this in the East and you get it in the West. Also, this disembodiment from one's own bodily longings and desires. In some ways, I want to look at an ecology of the mind, the body, the heart, and the spirit together, that actually they can't really be seen in isolation from one another. If we try to see them in isolation from one another, we're climbing on the pulpit of one or the other of them. Often we try and sort it out from the place of the spirit, and then we're in the disembodied pulpit talking to the rest of us, or we're in the body saying we need to let it all hang out, and we're talking then to the rest of us, to the intellectual part of us from the pulpit of the body. The way I want to look at these issues, look at patience and passions on the spiritual journey, is through the medium of poetry and through the poetic tradition. I want to look at the religious aspects, the psychological aspects, the bodily aspects, and the just plain everyday living aspects of what it means to be on this adventure together. So I'll start with a poem by William Carlos Williams, which is a good one to start with, because he says, "My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many men. My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many women. Look at what passes for the news. Look, just look, just look at what passes for the news. You will not find it there, but in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems, but men and women die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. But men and women die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. My heart rouses, thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many men, concerns many women. Look at what passes for the news. Look at what passes for the news. You will not find it there, but in despised poems." I love that line. "But in despised poems." So that I bring you to you this weekend, despised poems. "It is difficult to get the news from poems, but men and women die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." What is it that's found there? In my own explorations, my own study of the poetic tradition, it's first-hand experience. My own study of the Zen tradition. Where first-hand experience is your own first-hand meeting with life. It's almost the place where the soul exists. You know, Novalis, the great German romantic poet, said that the soul actually only exists where the spirit meets matter. Where your particular spiritual approach to the world actually meets life itself. The soul exists only where they touch. some ways, poetry is the way of carrying into speech, into communicative form, that moment where things touch together. So a great poem is not about an experience, it is the experience itself. The experience itself can actually come alive in the room. And what's marvelous about it is everyone can walk into that experience in their own way. In some ways, the only way a poet has into this place is through their own deep privacy. That's for British poets. For American poets, it's their own deep privacy. But the task is to go to such a deep privacy that the privacy belongs to everyone. You suddenly enter this extraordinary commonality. And you don't know how you've done it. Now, not all poetry does this. If you buy a Hallmark card that says your life is a symphony, this is not the great commonality. This is an affirmation at a kind of, in some ways, at a very surface level. Because the part of us for whom life is not a symphony immediately feels ashamed. Or has to be covered up. Whereas to a master like the German poet Rilke, he did not say my life is a symphony. He said, I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord because death's note wants to climb over. And in the dark interval reconciled, they stay there trembling and the song goes on beautiful. I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord because death's note wants to climb over. Death's note wants to climb over, and in the dark interval reconciled, they stay there trembling, and the song goes on beautiful. Und das Lied bleibt schön. And the song goes on beautiful. He begins this poem by saying, my life is not this steeply sloping hour in which you see me hurrying. Much stands behind me, I stand before it like a tree. I am only one of many mouths, and at that, the one that would be still the soonest. I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord, because death's note wants to climb over, and in the dark interval reconciled, they stay there trembling, and the song goes on beautiful. What I want to look at this weekend is this astonishing burden we carry of always needing to be the notes. To such a point in our psyches that our life, the notes jam together into this monotone, a kind of 60-cycle hum, which, like an old rattling refrigerator, you only notice when it's turned off. Notice that? So patience and passion on the spiritual journey, perhaps passion are the notes, patience is the space between the notes. Perhaps passion is the space between the notes, patience is the notes. For each one of us it changes at different times. But what's it like to give equal credence to both of them? To give up a monocultural view of our existence on this planet and to take on an ecological view, where ecological means the study of home. How do you study your own true home? In the Zen tradition, they use this metaphor again and again. They talk about your own true home. And in the Zen tradition, as in the poetic tradition, your own true home is your own first-hand experience. And the natural fire in the title here for this weekend is the natural fire of first-hand experience, whatever that might be. And to my mind, the soul doesn't really care whether that experience is socially good or socially bad, or whether it's a joyful experience or a grieful experience, whether it's a bitter experience or a sweet experience. The soul, in my experience, and the stories I've read that I've been told, and the poems I've read, in the silence I've sat in, the soul is interested only in the fact of whether that is your own grief, your own bitterness, your own joy. It would prefer its own bitterness than someone else's joy, than trying to live out someone else's joy. Whether that is your mother's joy, or your father's joy, or your colleague's joy, or your boss's joy, or your children's joy. What's my own way in the world? But the question asked in a way in which you ask, what is my own way in the world, and the weight of that question is actually leading you to the great commonality. Here's a poem by Pablo Neruda where he looks back at the beginning of his life when he first took on his poetic destiny, and he made this step into the great commonality, and he did it through the fire of his own first-hand experience. He said, y algo golpeaba en mi alma fiebre o alas perdidas y me fui haciendo solo, descifrando aquella quemadura y escribí la primera línea vaga, vaga, sin cuerpo, pura tontería, pura sabiduría del que no sabe nada y vi de pronto el cielo desgranado y abierto. And something ignited in my soul, fever or unremembered wings, and I went my own way, deciphering that burning fire. And I went my own way, deciphering that burning fire, and I wrote the first bare line, bare, without substance, pure foolishness, pure wisdom of one who knows nothing. And suddenly I saw the heavens unfastened and open. And suddenly, y vidi pronto el cielo desgranado y abierto, and suddenly I saw the heavens unfastened and open. Y algo golpeaba en mi alma, and something ignited in my soul, fiebre o alas perdidas, fever or unremembered wings, and I went my own way, y me fui haciendo solo, descifrando aquella quemadura, marvelous line, deciphering that burning fire. And I went my own way, deciphering that burning fire. And I wrote the first bare line, y escribí la primera línea vaga, vaga sin cuerpo, bare, without substance, pure foolishness, pura tontería, pura sabiduría, pure wisdom of one who knows nothing, del que no sabe nada. Y vidi pronto el cielo desgranado y abierto, and suddenly I saw the heavens unfastened and open. And something ignited in my soul, fever or unremembered wings, and I went my own way. I went my own way, deciphering that burning fire. And I wrote the first bare line, pure foolishness, pure wisdom, bare, without substance, pure foolishness, pure wisdom of one who knows nothing, one who knows nothing, and suddenly I saw the heavens unfastened and open. The question that this poem leaves in our own bodies is, did we go our own way? Did you go your own way? Not in the selfish sense of turning away from the world, but did you go your own way into the world? Or has it been someone else's way? Or what particular coloration has it taken? You know, at times we do go our own way, but then we get to a certain point of the cycle and we go someone else's way in order to get through that particular initiation. We have a kind of ersatz experience of it and then move on, or try to move on, and all the time this thing is tugging back at us, because there's a certain point along the path where you tuck on another's mask to get through. There's a marvelous poem which is actually a kind of teaching gatha from the Zen tradition by an 8th century Zen master called Kukai, which is called Singing Images of Fire. It's been translated by Jane Hirschfield, great translator, young woman, lives on the West Coast. She lives in Marin County. She still manages to do marvelous translations even though she lives in Marin County. Kukai says, says you want to know about the creative path, you want to know about enlightenment, you want to know about anything, he says, just move your hand. He says, the hand moves and the fire's whirling takes different shapes. The hand moves. He says, just move your hand, that's all. Don't worry about theology, just move your hand. The hand moves and the fire's whirling takes different shapes. All things change when we do. The first word, ah. The first word, ah. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. The hand moves and the fire's whirling takes different shapes. Feel this image of the fanning the flames here. Fan the flames. In some ways this is Kukai's own longing. The hand moves and the fire's whirling takes different shapes. All things change when we do. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. These poems usually have one word where the whole entrance to the poem pivots around this one word. We know what the one word in this poem is, don't we? Ah. Ah. So the 3,000 mile ah. As Kukai doesn't say whatever, he doesn't say that, it doesn't matter what you say. It's true, he doesn't say that. He says, first you have to get the ah. I think there's two R's in here. I think one of the reflexes we have, and it's kind of a reflex of our shame, is that we think this is totally the R of inspiration, of enlightenment, of peak experience, of entrance. My experience is there's another R here, which is the R of Monday morning, driving to work through the rain with the windscreen wipers. Going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. The R of exile, of second-hand experience. And that in some ways this short poem in which we travel thousands of miles towards our true home is like a ritual dance. Just as this weekend is like a ritual dance. You know, I think as human beings, we're creatures of forgetting. We oughtn't to be called Homo sapiens. We should be called Homo forgettens. And that again and again, the function of art, religion, psychology is to remind us. And the Greeks, their word for truth, aletheia, the root meaning of aletheia was no forgetting. I mean, no forgetting your truth. The truth of a person was their ability not to forget. And what you were not supposed to forget was this, that your soul was hung between these two points, the point of exile and the point of being home. And that the human condition is to accept both. And that the stepping into your own ah is to take the ah of entrance and the ah of bitterness, rejection, isolation, loss, woundedness. And live your life as Rilke did between the two notes. And that in some ways, much of our misery comes from choosing. We force ourselves to choose, just as we force ourselves to choose between those two kinds of time. So that when we say, I'm going to make more time for myself, the strategic mind comes in a wonderful way. And even though we're trying to get through the strategic mind to a deeper mind, the strategic mind comes in and says, yes, we'll do it between 6 and 6:45 on Wednesday evenings. That's make that time to sit down and meditate, you see. And what we do is we pack in the rest of the day to make more time between 6 and 6:45, and so you're rushing around right up to the moment, 6 o'clock. Sit down on your cushion or sit in your corner, whatever it is, and go to 6:45, and then up you go and off. You know that feeling? I mean, it happens with vacations too. You need a vacation after all the preparation you've done for it and going off. It's an old joke. It's so true. In other words, our experience is coming out of our time. We are crushing our experience into our idea of what time is. What would it be like to let our experience come out of time itself? To have time come out of our experience. You have your experience. And the time of day, the time, literally, we have so many emphases on that word, time. Time for what? It is time, we say. It is time, meaning something prescient is about to happen. Well, in some ways, the only way we ever know that is if we have a tremendous amount of silence in our lives. I'm very happy to be here this weekend, you know, in the auspices of the Friends Conference, where silence is has been such an astonishing part of the tradition. Because to me, silence is the not necessarily quiet, though it most often is, but it's the capacity not to already have the answer when you ask the question. It's the capacity to allow room. The silence, in some ways, is the room in which the question can grow. I am the rest between two notes that are somehow always in discord, because death's note wants to climb over, and in the dark interval reconciled they stay there trembling, and the song goes on. Beautiful. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. As we set off on this journey, what I want to, over the weekend, hopefully I can, through the poetic tradition, build up a kind of phenomenology of the path. In other words, phenomenology, what happens along the way. You want to start on this journey, you say, I want to go into silence, I want to go into this greater commonality, but I want to enter that commonality in a way which is my own way. No one else can do it in the way I can. And no one else can fail at doing it in the way I can. That somehow the stakes are understood to be very high. The stakes of your life. And what the mythic and poetic traditions teach us is that it doesn't matter where you are in the story. If you can tell the story well enough, then you can understand the magnificence of the place you are in. Even if that magnificence is a kind of bitter magnificence of the phrase, I cannot take another step, I cannot go on. What is it like to enter into that fire to say, this is my own, I cannot go on-ness. This is my own, I cannot go on-ness. No one else can experience this, I cannot go on-ness in this particular way. This is the suchness of my existence. And this is the way I tell the story. This is my story. In the old Celtic tradition, especially in the Irish tradition, the bard, the poet, was the person who was asked to be able to say this not only for themselves but for their culture as a whole. A fully trained bard had the same standing as an aristocrat or a king, because their function was understood to be was to pass on the understanding of where the people had come from. You learned all the genealogies of the people and all the great stories that had happened. The migrations, the battles, the dwelling places, the losses, the gains. But you were also trained so that you could spontaneously speak to any moment as it occurred. So if something was happening and people didn't know how to deal with it, often they would say something, you know, Sabat, and he would speak to it, speak into it through his training. And the kind of training they had, we only have a few kind of anecdotes passed down through the centuries of what they went through, but one of the things, one kind of training we know they went through was to stand, you know, as a kind of final, one of their final tests, they were immersed up to their necks in cold, freezing cold water with pebbles in their mouths, and then they had to extemporize 500 lines of iambic pentameter on a given subject, you see. This was taken very seriously, so they would say, put the pebbles in your mouth, clouds, 500 lines. So because it was understood that this was necessary for the people. And they had the equivalence of this in all their arts, from astronomy through to dance, through to music. My friend Angelis Ariane, when she studies the cultures around the world, she finds that one of the questions that primary cultures ask when someone is sick is they say, when did you stop singing? When did you stop dancing? When did you stop speaking, saying it? When did you stop drumming? When did you stop using your imagination? Astonishing, simple question. Question itself is not the cure, but the way to where the question will take you if you take it on. Take you down into the earth, down into yourself. So the place of the poet, the bard, man or woman, they were both, was to be able to say where the people had come from. Tradition, it says, in the beginning was the word. I think this is what this meaning of the word is. It's the word that says it, that says this is the story. And when the word is spoken, suddenly the hoop is made whole. You know, the hoop that Black Helt spoke about. The hoop that was broken is made whole. Well, all of us have our own equivalents. You know, my way is poetry. Other way, people's way is pottery. Sculpture, reading itself, or even just the art of conversation, of being there at the right time for someone else coming along the road. We all have our ways in the world. What's our own equivalent of that? Normally when we start into it, we start where Dante started with his great epic, one of the great epics of Western literature, the Divine Comedy. And he starts in a very honest and real place. Everybody knows how to start in this place. So lines of great compassion, because he says, nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai in un'oscura selva. In the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood. Which the path was wholly lost. In the middle of the road of my life, nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai in una scura selva. In the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the path was wholly lost. Seems to me that it's exactly at this place of being lost that in some ways our powers are most efficient. Not because we're essentially that way, but because at some time the eldership in our cultures of teaching you what to do when you were lost has been lost itself. Our eldership is very good at telling you what to do when you know you're found. It's very good at telling you what to do when you're successful, when you're on top of the world, or at pointing one towards success. But it's spent very little time, in fact it's disowned the time between the notes. Here's a poem from a tradition where that hadn't been lost. It's a Northwest Indian teaching story. And it's the kind of story that would be told to a young boy or girl who asked the question, "What do I do when I'm lost in the forest?" It's been adapted into modern English by David Wagoner. And the poem is called Lost, which is a great place to start any conference. Lost. If you go to the Northwest, there are only small areas of these great climax forests left, but originally they were, had a 200-foot canopy, 300-foot canopy. These enormous trees, you couldn't see more than 100 yards or so. There's moss, ferns, salal growing beneath them. So it mattered in a very essential and practical way. "What do I do when I'm lost in the forest, Grandpa?" you say. Grandma, as a child. In some ways, the child asks the same, a street kid in Philadelphia asks the same question, except the answer is no longer forthcoming in the same way. Because this is what the elder says. The elder says, "You're lost, eh?" He says, "Well, stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost." Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, the forest breathes, it whispers, "I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, 'Here.' No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you."
Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost.
Wherever you are is called here. Wherever you are is called here. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, the forest breathes. It whispers, "I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, 'Here.' No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you."
Says, "You're not the one to figure it out."
What he says is, you pay tremendous attention to the world, and then the world speaks back to you, and it's in that speaking back that you find where you are. First of all, he says, you must pay attention. You cannot sleepwalk your way into this. And there's part of us that loves to believe that if only you can keep your head down low enough, get the right pension plan, that somehow you'll be able to coast through to the end. You won't get hit by any blunt objects along the way. And the wish is for immunity. And in some ways, as we work from the strategic mind, The strategic mind understands intuitively where the danger lies to its own solid sense of identity that it's built. And in some ways, the strategic mind has become like an inner Saddam Hussein. It's committed a kind of palace coup and taken over the life of the soul. Not that there's anything wrong with the strategic mind, it just seems to me that it's in the wrong place at the moment. The strategic mind is meant as an elaborative way of living in the world. It's meant to help arrange things just at certain times so the soul can have the vehicle to move into the world. But at some time or another, we got so scared that we invited the strategic mind into the central throne. And it sits there like Richard III, scared to death of anything that might shake the kingdom. It's interesting that Saddam Hussein was beaten publicly as a child, literally in public. His stepfather would beat him with sticks in front of other people. And so, to that man, compounded with the custom of the Arab culture also, it's impossible. That man feels his soul is at stake if he's seen to be beaten in public. And so he could not withdraw from Kuwait. He could not move from there. In some ways, the strategic mind had been invited in to protect the soul at a particular time. But then we've lost the eldership of knowing when to say to the strategic mind, it's all right now, the danger's gone away, you can move away, thank you for protecting me. I discovered this part of myself actually just in the last couple of years. It's the part of me that will go for the jugular. I call this part Mordred. Mordred in the Arthurian myths. There's no kind of ritual aggressive dance to this part of me. It just goes straight for home, the throat. And I went into this part of myself to ask what this is about. And I realized that in some ways Mordred was a very selfless figure. He was there at my beck and call. It's just that no one had taught me how to look at that part of myself and say, it's fine, Mordred, you don't have to do that. I'm not in danger anymore. And as soon as I said that to that part of myself, Mordred said, oh, fine, well, I'm just over here. Anytime, just give the... I was astonished. I expected this huge battle, pouting, emotional recrimination, emotional blackmail. There's nothing. He just said, fine, I'm over here. You want me? Yes. And I can still call on him, so be careful. Don't you? How did we get onto this? Stand still, the trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. The elder's asking for attention. That's right. The strategic mind understands that there are tremendous consequences simply to paying attention. That simply by paying attention you are changed. And the deeper the attention, the deeper the change. All things change when we do. That at some strange part, and I want to go into this phenomenon in more depth later on, at a point at which you pay attention to the world and that attention turns into praise, there's an initiatory point that we travel over in which the world suddenly starts to pay attention back. And that's a very fiery moment. There's a natural fire in itself, because at that point the vehicle that has carried our identity is not commensurate to the answer, to the immensity of the answer. The questioner who asks the question, what do I do when I'm lost in the forest, does not survive the immensity of the answer. So the first part is the elder says you must pay tremendous attention. You can't sleepwalk into this hoping out things will turn right. You can't sleepwalk into life hoping things will turn out right. The second part is the silence in this poem. You must look hard and long enough at the things of the world so that they have time to speak back to you. You are not going to supply the answer. The world supplies the answer. And then the third part, which is, and then you must be prepared to have the answer stand, the question stood on its head. The question will not be commensurate to the answer. Any real answer will consume your question. So this is the other part of the fire. Fire is a marvelous image because on the one hand it nourishes us. It's the hearth at the center of our home. We gather, the family gathers around it. If you want to bring some Bonhomie into a house, you light a fire. You know, at the center of it, people gather around, the glow on people's faces, the smoke rising, the heat. We cook our foods on it. So it's a place of tremendous nourishment, both metaphoric and practically in our life. And at the same time, it's also the consuming flame. It can also burn your house down. I want to finish with a poem which I wrote recently, which has to do with one of the great archetypical moments of seeing fire, which is Moses before the burning bush. This poem is called Fire in the Earth. It's the title poem of my next book. For me, there's a moment when all of us are Moses. It's that point of stepping over, through, and into that fire. And there's a tremendous precision to the teaching of this image. Yes, isn't it marvelous? You get to your great moment in life where actually you're going to hear the voice of God. And as always, you do not get the Ten Commandments first time. First of all, you get this strange injunction which says, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground. You say, wait a minute, you know, 10 years of spiritual practice, take off my shoes, what is this? Part of you says that. But if you're willing to take the deeper step of attention, say, take off your shoes, you are standing on holy ground. To me, the moment of Moses' revelation in some ways was not seeing the burning bush that took him to the initiatory door. The moment was when he looked down and saw that he was standing in his own true home, on his own ground, of his own first-hand experience. And what's more, he had been standing there all his life.
In exile.
So fire in the earth. And we know when Moses was told, in the way he was told, take off your shoes, he grew pale from that simple reminder of fire in the dusty earth. He grew pale from that simple reminder of fire in the dusty earth. He never recovered his complicated way of loving again and was free to love in the same way he felt the fire in the earth licking at his heels, as if the lion earth could roar and take him in one movement. Every step he took from there was carefully placed. Everything he said mattered, as if he knew the constant witness of the ground, as if he knew the constant witness of the ground and remembered his own face in the dust the moment before revelation, like the moment you too saw for the first time your own house turned to ashes. Everything consumed so the road could open again, your entire presence in your eyes and the world turning slowly into a single branch of flame. And we know when Moses was told, in the way he was told, take off your shoes, he grew pale from that simple reminder of fire in the dusty earth. He never recovered his complicated way of loving again, and was free to love in the same way he felt the fire licking at his heels loved him, as if the lion earth could roar and take him in one movement. Every step he took from there was carefully placed. Everything he said mattered, as if he knew the constant witness of the ground and remembered his own face in the dust the moment before revelation. Since then, thousands have felt the same immobile tongue with which he tried to speak. Since then, thousands have felt the same immobile tongue with which he tried to speak. Like the moment you too saw, for the first time, your own house turned to ashes. Everything consumed so the road could open again, your entire presence in your eyes, and the world turning slowly into a single branch of flame. Now, we've all driven great distances today. We're tired, which is a good place to start also. Tired of ourselves, we open ourselves to ourselves at last. There's a place to get tired of oneself. So what I would ask, as we go off to our first night's sleep during the conference, I would just ask you to, in the spirit of the conference, to look at your life as if it is a forest again, as if you're seeing it for the first time. With such new eyes that you have the possibility of being lost in it again. Stand still, the trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. Listen, forest breeze, it whispers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, here. No two trees are the same to raven, no two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a branch does is lost on you, then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you.